Morning. Deciding to decide, or the art and practice of revelation. I begin this morning with a pertinent definition. Revelation is an act revealing a divine truth, something that is revealed by God, an act making something known, a pleasant, often enlightening surprise. Underscore enlightening. Like many members of this congregation, I began my religious life as a Christian. In my case, I was raised in the bosom of the infallible Presbyterian Church. However, as the years passed and I continued both my formal and my informal education, I found myself faced with a problem. Part of each Sunday worship service was reciting the Nicene Creed, thereby attesting to the notion of a God the Father, a God the Son, and a God the Holy Ghost, concluding with belief in a risen Christ who had, a very long time ago, for reasons I never did understand, died so God the Father would forgive humanity's sins, mine included. I'm not making light of that matter. Like many of you, I recited those statements of faith with as much honesty as I could muster. Also, like many of you, or you wouldn't be here today, by the time I was a college student, I realized I did not believe what the language claimed. Thus, as the years passed, I was caught between the psychological need to belong to a religious tribe and the intellectual need to take language seriously. In 1975, I decided to decide. That is, I opted for taking language seriously, which meant I became a Unitarian. After all, I reasoned, what distinguishes the human species from our brother and sister species is the complexity of our language. And for me, as a writer, life only becomes real and reasonable when we can say it in words. Ironically, when I became a Unitarian, I found myself facing a new question. For we Unitarian Universalists also use language each Sunday. The most intriguing to me is the statement, we believe that revelation is continuous. We believe that revelation is continuous. Simple, right? Simple and straightforward. No fixing on some ancient text for literal or poetic truth. None of the bumper sticker theology I once saw that read, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. A statement which I still find absurd in the extreme. At the same time, at least for me, the statement we believe that revelation is continuous begs two serious questions that I take seriously. First, how does revelation take place? And second, what is being revealed? For if we really do hold that revelation is continuous, if we hold that revelation happens at all, then intellectual honesty suggests we must at least try to answer those two questions. Now, I am not a fool. At least I trust I'm not fool-headed. I assume there's nothing I'm going to say this morning that individuals in this congregation have not already asked themselves. All I wish to do is contribute my thinking to the general consideration. I will begin by dividing religious practice into three groups that I believe exemplify three ways of regarding both the act and practice of revelation. Three groups I have chosen to call hard believers, soft believers, and non-believers. First, hard believers, or God speaks. Hard believers contend sacred literature's divine sources, each of whom created and maintains the universe while also being external to the universe. That is, creator gods are up there or out there someplace. they see all, know all, and can alter all. No matter if it's the Torah, the New Testament, the Quran, the Vedas, or any number of other sacred texts, from the point of view of hard believers, those literatures speak eternal truths transmitted by divinely inspired minds who, in their dictations, define the nature of the creators, the relationship of the creators to the creation, the role each believing group plays in expanding and maintaining a particular divine truth in this otherwise sinful world, the role of the individual in that great obligation, and woe be he or she who tries to persuade hard believers otherwise. From that point on, unless there is some serious disruption, hard believers will see the world through the fixed lens of the literatures that have been accepted. Sincere and studious and dedicated hard believers read, interpret, and then apply specific, limited, absolute groupthink to history, to society, to their lives. For each hard believer has decided to decide that there's only one truth. Second, soft believers, or the universe, speaks. Soft believers are even more interesting, for soft believers allow doubt and questions into their religious equations. While soft believers usually maintain the notion that the universe is animated by what might be called a divine presence, or a divine source, or a divine energy, soft believers reject the thesis that only one truth is the final truth. For soft believers agree, the universe is a complex place. Soft believers admit we do not know everything about the universe, that we may never know everything there is to know about the universe. For soft believers, a balance must be maintained between scientific, rational information and a psychological desire to respond to the sometimes wonderful and sometimes difficult experience of being human. Thus, soft believers find evidence of divine energy in nature, in music, in art, in love relationships, even in ancient forms of worship that lie outside orthodox religious disciplines. Soft believers, agnostics, deists, or theists, soft believers hold that divine wisdom reveals itself within the universe. It's just that we human beings are not yet intellectually or emotionally equipped to unravel the great mystery. So soft believers have decided to decide that the mystery will probably remain a mystery forever, which for soft believers is not only an acceptable notion, it's comforting. If there's no absolute demand to decide absolutely, then soft believers can experience more of life's joys than hard believers who demand the world conform to their more rigid definition of spiritual truth. Third, non-believers, or humanity, speaks. If you keep in mind that atypical means not typical, then atheist means no theism, that is, no God, no divine wisdom creating, sustaining, animating, regulating, or supervising the universe. For non-believers, the universe is a melding of chemicals, energy, and heat, governed by the universal laws of mathematics and physics. Thus, the universe will not and cannot be comprehended through the lens of sacred literature or mystical experience. After all, non-believers reason, if you want to understand the universe, then study the universe. If you want to understand the role of human beings in life on Earth, then study human evolutionary history. If you want to define your own place in the scheme of things, well, then go study the scheme of things and study your own psyche. In brief, hard believers have decided to decide that the gods of the universe reveal themselves in sacred literature. Soft believers have decided to decide that the universe is a manifestation of divine energy to be experienced intuitively, emotionally, aesthetically. By contrast, non-believers have decided to decide that all of the time and effort that goes into worshiping the gods or thinking about the gods or trying to experience the gods in nature is a monumental waste of time. Interesting only because it says a great deal about the various and varied gatherings of people who exercise one sort of belief or another, about a metaphysical universe, about metaphysical wisdom. Now, at this point, it may sound as if I'm rejecting all possible ways in which revelation might be continuous, but that is not the case. There is more to be said about the subject of revelation. However, to do so requires that I examine the notion, the Carl Jungian notion, that in fact there is a discernible wisdom at work in the human experience, a wisdom that resides and functions deep within us, deep in our species, deep in who we are, deep in what I hold is continuous revelation. I'm not going to discuss the story of the Big Bang that would eventually lead to orbiting planetary objects, among them the Earth, which would eventually lead to water species, then toss some of the water species up on land, which would eventually lead to the evolution of ape-like species, which would eventually lead to us. Suffice it to say, the evolutionary history of the varied species that led to human beings began with reptiles. As a consequence, at the base of our skulls, whether we like it or not, we carry the reptilian brainstem, which is responsible for survival auto behaviors, such as digestion, circulation, breathing, reproduction, as well as the aggressive struggle for territorial dominance, the fight or flight mechanism. Next, in some species, including those that would lead more directly to us, is the mammalian brain, which is responsible for characteristics such as romantic love, sex drive, memory, awareness, thought, consciousness. Last in human evolution is the neomammalian brain, or neocortex, a very thin veneer covering the mammalian cortex. The neomammalian neocortex is responsible for language, abstract thought, planning, perception. The point is, given the way the human brain evolved, it is reasonable to argue that the human mind, which is the brain in action, the human mind carries deep within it intelligence that began in the Earth's earliest slime, or as Reverend J. Deacon put it, humankind is evolution becoming aware of itself. But what does that have to do with we believe revelation is continuous? Everything. I contend everything. According to psychoanalyst Carl Jung, our minds function at three interconnected levels, starting with consciousness, which allows for everyday participation in our busy lives. That is, conscious awareness of who we are and where we are, conscious awareness of immediate memories, even of recalled memories. Next is the pre- or subconsciousness, the most important part of the Jungian schema, which is the part of our brain that conjures and processes dreams, a halfway house between our conscious minds and the last layer, the unconsciousness, which Jung defined as a vast storehouse of two kinds of materials. First, we do not enter the world tabula rasa with blank slate minds. We enter life equipped with what Jung and others termed the universal collective unconsciousness. But we are born knowing because we are human beings, because we will experience and understand the world from within the limitations as well as the potentials of our species. In Jung's terms, we come into the world equipped with a body of archetypal dream images that will transform into specific identities when we enter conscious life. Thus, the universal collective unconsciousness is a storehouse of intelligence and comprehension we will later call intuition. Intelligence and comprehension allowing for a profound awareness of our connection not only to our genetic inheritance, but to our cellular inheritance as well. Some scientists claim goes all the way back to the Big Bang. Second, each of us carries in our unconsciousness every sensation we have ever felt, every experience we have ever undergone, beginning in the womb, continuing throughout our lives, ending only when we die. The Jungian construct argues then that when we delve deeply into our part of the universal collective unconsciousness, usually while dreaming, but meditation and art and music can have a similar impact. Jung argues that when we delve deeply, our psychic life goes on, which means in Jung's thinking, the dream may be regarded as the result of unconscious processes obtruding on consciousness. When that happens, when unconsciousness wisdom percolates up into the subconsciousness, we achieve a level of insight and psychological freedom that allows us to access a vast reservoir of wisdom, a vast reservoir of spiritual comprehensions that far exceed anything offered by conventional religious disciplines. My point is that when we enter that most profound zone of our wisdom, when we enter our individual share of the universal collective unconsciousness, disconnected momentarily from our conscious lives, freed from our conscious concerns, when we enter the universal collective unconsciousness, we commune with the universe. We commune with creation. We are at one with ourselves. We are at one with life. In Jung's words, the universal collective unconsciousness contains the whole spiritual heritage of humankind's evolution, born anew in the brain structure of every individual. For each of us carries the germ seed of universal collective unconsciousness wisdom. In other words, non-believer believers have decided to decide we are all riding on our share of an unseen subterranean unconsciousness if we only knew how to access our own, and if we only knew how to grasp the notion that when we sit together in silence, it is possible we are riding together the universal unconsciousness wavelengths that join us to the only true spiritual wisdom we will ever need. So what in the world does all of that mean? What does all of that have to do with the Unitarian statement that revelation is continuous? My answer, everything. Because the universal collective unconsciousness never stops flowing. The universal collective unconsciousness never rests. The universal collective unconsciousness is continuous revelation. And the universal collective unconsciousness, what poet William Butler Yeats termed spiritus mundi, the universal soul, the universal collective unconsciousness is our connection to the body of inherited wisdom that makes us human, that makes us humane, that allows us to achieve what J. Deacon termed the authentic self, which is, after all, the stated aim of all religions. The problem is finding a way to get there. The problem is knowing we are there if we do get there. Of course, no one ever said meditation and/or dreaming at that level of sensitivity would be easy. If it were, everyone would decide to do it. However, because I contend that is what we mean when we say we believe revelation is continuous, I believe it's vital that we try. Of course, as is always the case here at First Unitarian, What you decide to decide about all I've said this morning is up to you. So be it.